unit and the HALO module. Initially, they plan on sending those two out separately and have them dock in, you know, dock in lunar orbit. And they decided against that. They said, let me just use the heavier SpaceX Falcon Heavy, which is one with three cores attached, puts over 5 million pounds of thrust. And what we'll do is we'll bolt the PPE and the HALO unit together on Earth, put it into the fairing of SpaceX Falcon, and send it on the way to the moon. Again, these two heavy units, even that rocket doesn't have enough oomph to send it directly to the moon into lunar orbit. But it does have enough power to get it into an elliptical orbit around Earth. So the plan right now is once PPE and HALO are in Earth orbit, because the PPE has solar panels and also has three ion engines attached to it. Three ion engines will be able to fire either together or independently. So once it's in elliptical orbit around Earth, these engines will start, you know, every time it gets into the part of Earth, orbit near Earth, it'll ignite its engines further and further out each time it goes around Earth. Eventually, the idea will be to break the orbit and eventually go into lunar orbit. You know, but it sounds easier said than done. These engines will have to be for a year. Will take a year to push power propulsion and that first livable quarters to get these two units into lunar orbit. You'd have to fire these ion engines for almost a year before it gets there. So that's interesting. And then once it's in orbit, it'll put itself down again with the same ion engine. It'll eventually wind up roughly a 40,000 mile by I think roughly around 1,000 mile orbit initially. So highly elliptical, where it will take roughly I think it's 11 days to make one orbit. And then, you know, that'll be the permanent location of Gateway. They know that's a stable orbit because right now we have one CubeSat that was launched by Rocket Lab a few years ago. They sent it out of orbit, and that's where it is. And the purpose of that flight was to make sure that this highly elliptical orbit, 11 orbit, is stable. So that's where Gateway is going to wind up. I found that interesting. It would take roughly a year to get the first two elements out to the orbit of the moon. Now followed by the IHAB, which is the one being built by European Space Agency and JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency. And that the idea is to eventually take that one and dock now that's not going to have the PPE attached to it, so they want to have enough power to push that thing all the way to the moon. To do that, they're not going to use SpaceX Falcon Heavy, because that's not big enough. And no, they're not going to use SpaceX new Starship, you know, although they probably like to. They're going to use the Space Launch System. So that would be on Artemis 4. You'll have a crew on board on this new Space Launch System. Don't forget, that's still been tested out a year and a half or so ago when they launched a 25-day mission around the moon using the new Space Launch System. And this will be even more powerful. They're going to have more powerful boosters, and they're going to have a more powerful upper stage instead of one liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine pushing 20,000 pounds. They're going to have four of them, almost 100,000 pounds of pressure, thrust, capability. You know, it'll be a much bigger upgraded system, and they'll push enough to push a crew and this third module into lunar orbit. So what they'll do is launch into Earth orbit first, and then they'll something similar to what the Apollos used to do. Remember the Apollo missions before they went to the moon? They would go into Earth orbit, and then they would undock from the upper stage. They would turn around 180 degrees. The crew would come in slowly, and they would dock to the LEM. Of course, the LEM was the lunar module. Then they would fly on. That configuration would fly on to the moon. And eventually the crew would transfer into the LEM. Well, two people would. It would be one behind. In this case, what they'll do is have a crew of four. They'll do the same thing. They'll operate from the upper stage, 180-degree turn. They'll dock with the IHAB, and eventually they would use that, and they could actually fly it. And, they could go inside that on the way to the moon. When they get to the moon, they'll dock with the already in orbit propulsion module, along with the other module that's been placed in orbit. And they'll dock together, and you'll have the beginning of a complete space station. So, linear-wise, in line, you'd have the propulsion line, with the solar panels sticking out, with the engines on it, the Hall effect, three-ion engines, followed by the first module, the Halo module, living quarters, followed by another living quarter module, IHAB, and then on the radio ports, you'll have other equipment that will be eventually docked to that. But on the actual port, on the far end, you'll be able to dock spacecraft coming from Earth, like Orion spacecraft, and these other radio ports, you would have one little module that they would use for having fuel set up, and then eventually cargo, that would all be attached to that one. Another radial port would eventually have an airlock where you could you could be on board in spacewalk if you had to. And then another module, of course, would be for the whatever lunar vehicle is going up and down to the moon. Eventually two more docking ports, because you eventually might have two of them permanently docked. Don't forget the ones that go up and down to the moon, Starship, and the one being built by Blue Origin, really Jeff Bezos' company, could be permanently attached to the space station. So a crew would come out, get on board, fly down, using one of those vehicles to the moon, come back up, and it would, stay attached to the space station and eventually be refueled in full vehicles. That is a long-term plan, so we've got a long way to go, though. But I thought I'd start talking about it now. Any comments or questions for this portion of the stuff I've seen?
Yes, I got one question about the Boeing Starlink.
Oh, okay, Charlie. Yeah, Boeing Starliner. Hopefully that gets off the ground. What did I say, June 1st? Back to you.
Yeah, now they got a helium leak. Could that be used too much wear? Reusing this rocket over and over again?
Oh, yeah, in the future? Well, the leak is in the service module. Now, the Starliner consists of the Starliner vehicle itself with the crew, and that's the part with the heat shield that will eventually be returned safely to the Earth. Behind that heat shield, you have the service module. The service module gives you all the things that the crew needs to live. Power, because it's going to have solar panels sticking out, four of them. So it give them electricity. It'll give them oxygen tanks back there, and water, that they're going to need for drinking. That's the service module, so that's similar to what the Apollo system had. The Apollo had the spacecraft, and then they had the service module. Well, in the service module part, they have, I think there's something like 28, I want to say 28 thrusters that they have. You know, so you could reorient yourself in space if you need be. And a couple of bigger thrusters, which are used to maneuver in space, you know, push yourself either to the space station or eventually go orbit. You know. So that service module has a lot of these thrusters in it. And those thrusters are the ones that to operate. They have hypergolic fuel. To operate, they need to be pushed, and they need to be pushed with something. And so they're using a helium to do that. So once this thing launches and docks at the space station, and then eventually returns a week or so later, one of the pieces that separate before the crew returns in the spaceship with the heat shield, one of the pieces that separate is the service module. And that thing separates, and that thing, that part burns up in the atmosphere. That, again, we'll never be able to look at it or evaluate it, but they do know what's happening. Future service modules, you know, every launch that goes up, the vehicle itself will be reusable. The Starship will be reusable. But the service modules are not. Those burn up. So for every launch, you're going to burn up one service module. Service module is very important, and they have already planned to make sure you don't have any other fine little in the helium system. Anyway, back to you, Charlie.
Okay, I wanted to advance this. Now, the Russians, they had a moon landing. It didn't go well. Is there any way they could fix this problem?
The Russians, they haven't had an attempt in a couple of years. They tried to do that a couple of years, about a year and a half ago now. That was called Luna 26. And, yeah, that didn't make it at all. So, unfortunate for them. So they don't have to worry about fixing anything. All right, keep going.
Okay. Now, I've been looking at these. The station. Now they got four panels on them. Do they have battery backups for these?
Oh yes, they do. Oh sure. They have four sets of solar panels. The total power that they generate is around 160 kilowatts. 160. And now they've upgraded, and now will be 200 and I think 20, going up to around 220. They added some solar panels the last couple of years. They did a couple of spacewalks and added a couple of more solar panels. So this couple of hundred kilowatt system is constantly, naturally, it's feeding the entire 15 modules of the International Space Station. But it's also feeding batteries. They have, one time, when it was first launched, they had hydrogen type batteries that were on board the space. Like I said, in the last couple of years, they've upgraded them. They've gotten rid of these big old heavy batteries, and they've replaced with lithium batteries, much lighter. You know, collectively, half the amount of weight. Able to put out, you know, plenty of power. And there was 48 batteries. And each one weighed, I want to say, almost 400 pounds. And they came up on big pallets on the A2 rocket. They called it the HTV, which was Japan's contribution to sending stuff to the International Space Station, clothes, food, and all of that. They set up on their HTV on the H2 launch vehicle, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen launch vehicle from Japan, and couple of those flights, they would include these massive batteries on these big pallets, you know. And they would attach them to the space station, leave them there for a while until they did a spacewalk. And then they would start to install them. The pallet that went up, I think, it used to take two, sometimes three spacewalks with two people to disconnect the old ones and have them removed eventually by the Canadian robot arm too, would remove them. And eventually they would replace them with these other batteries. And crew would install these big jumper connections between them to bring them online. And I believe all that work is done. I don't think they have any more batteries that have to go up. So, yeah. And then, naturally, in darkness, you know, you're going around the Earth. Every 90 minutes you go around the Earth. Sometimes, not half, but, you know, maybe a third of the time, or better, you're in darkness. When you're in darkness, you need power. So these batteries would, you know, seamlessly, you know, supply power to the space station. So, you know, and when they you know, drop losing power, which is every 90 minutes, the solar panels are recharging them. So this happens every roughly 16 times a day. Charge, recharge, charge, charge, recharge. It's unbelievable. Because it does, you know, they do around 16 orbits per day. Back to you, Sean.
Now, these are 48 degrees. 400 pounds apiece?
I believe so. I believe so. I think that was the pallet contained, I think it was, each pallet was 12 batteries. Oh, I'll have to go back. We used to cover this on the net. I'll have to go back to my older nets and figure out exactly how many there were. But yeah, these things were heavy. And I think they used to take out 12, and they used to replace them with 9. They were not nickel hydrogen, but they were called something or other hydrogen. That escapes me. But they were these batteries, which would when they were charged, were highly pressurized. The battery would go up to like 1,200 psi, and it would go up, down, up. Very heavy, you know, but reliable, and they did away with them and switched to lithium. Back to you, Sean.
Yeah, that lithium battery must be awfully light compared to, and it saves a lot of space.
Yeah, I remember seeing the spacewalks, you know, and they got rid of the big heavy ones, and the new ones would be replaced. They would take a lot of the old ones and put it into the HCV cargo section. And when they, you know, HCV would, by Japan, they would eventually un from the space station and deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere. And they would take some of the batteries with them, along with all the junk and stuff that the astronauts wanted to get rid of. They did that with the HCV, and they do that with the Cygnus vehicles. They do that with the Russian Progress vehicles. SpaceX, they don't burn up. Their SpaceX cargo vehicle comes back on parachutes. That's how they get science information, science projects, and gear and port stuff back. Thousands of pounds every time a SpaceX Dragon lands. What an operation. We're up to almost 24 years now. Back to you, John.
I believe they had a launch today. I didn't see anything about
it. They seem to have launches every day, you know. The last one was China, you know. They sent up another Long March 2 rocket. That was supposed to go up on May 18th. That went up. And they were going to have surveillance cameras and things on that. That was followed, let's see, that was followed by a SpaceX launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base for the NRO, you know, the National Reconnaissance Office. They have all kinds of launches, you know, and you never know where they go because, you know, government, the guy, and they're the ones that are always surveilling. You never know if they're cameras. Most likely, they're list devices for the National Accounts Office. That's what they do. And they launched an unspecified amount of satellites on a SpaceX rocket from Vandenberg. So that tells you it was a polar. Anything that goes up from Vandenberg is usually a polar orbit. And the reason they do the polar orbit, they can come over the same area every time if they want to, you know, see what Russia or China's doing. They time it where every day there'll be at a certain time of day they're going to be in the same location. And what they do is they have half a dozen or dozens of these satellites, in one launch. And they're in line with one another, so you can get not only coverage for an instant period of time, but for many hours at a time, as each satellite goes over the same location. So that's what NRO usually does. So that was another launch last week. I think it was on the 22nd. We had another one, an Electron rocket by Rocca, that launched from New Zealand. I think it was a couple of days ago. That was a NASA. That was a top secret. That was a NASA contract. They signed up with Rocket Lab for that. Remember, Rocket Lab is an American company. It's right now they launch out of two locations: the North Island in New Zealand, and then they have two launch complexes there, and then they have one launch complex in the United States in Wallops Island, Virginia. They launch out of there as well. But they call this the pre-fire CubeSat, the Polar Radiant Energy and Infrared Experiment Mission. So these are two small satellites, very powerful, and their idea is to measure the amount of heat that rises in the planet and leaves the planet. From the name, it's called the pre-fire spacecraft. From the name, polar radiant, that tells you that, that was sent into a polar orbit as well. So they'll be able to know in the different poles, north and south, how much heat is coming in from the sun and how much is leaving. And right now we have no idea what it is. We have satellites all over detecting other areas, but not the polar areas. So these two will be important for NASA. I want to understand that was a successful mission. Right up on the Electron rocket. Back to you, Charlie. WS2N.
And they also launched a satellite to spy on the Russians.
Who did? We did? I'm sure we have dozens of them do that, but you're saying we had one that did that recently? I don't remember that one.
Yeah, this week.
Okay, well, more to marry you. You got to watch that group. I mean, they're trying to do the same to us, but I think we got them outnumbered. I'm sure we do. There's a company called RFA. It's Galactic Factory Augsburg. Come out of Germany. And very soon, I believe they will be launching their first rocket, the orbital rocket, more places from Scotland. Scotland has built a launch complex, and it'll be the first orbital launch from the UK, Scotland. I think it's pretty good. It's a good advancement. It's a German company, built this stainless steel rocket, and they just tested it the other day. They had a launch, a test facility set up, and they tested four of their new engines. They call them Helix engines, and eventually they plan on putting a lot more engines in this vehicle. And I think in the very near future, I would say within a couple of months, they'll probably have their first launch. I hope they make it to orbit. I always like these new companies that are up and coming. Give these other ones competition, especially SpaceX. They're running away with the program, you know. Countless launches. We'll have to see. But I'll keep my eye on it. On this company, Rocket Factory Augsburg, out of Augsburg, pretty should be good. The test was successful. I saw a clip on it, and they have their own little mission control, and they were all cheering when the test went well. You know, make sure all the engines light up properly in order. You know, they don't launch, they don't ignite at the same time. Most of that, in this case, a few seconds later, another one launches or ignites, and then they all stay on for a while, and they shut all down. So we'll see. Hope they make it. Any other comments from Charlie or anybody else? Okay, just want to mention Voyager.
SpaceX is going to launch ESA.
Voyager is now officially back online.
Satellite.
I talked about that, about their problem. Back in November, they lost their legible information, legible there, coming back from Voyager 1. And they had no idea what was up with that. And it took all these months, they figured it out. They figured out what chip was bad and how to get around it. Here's this thing, 160 billion miles, whatever it is, away from Earth, you know, four times, five times further than Pluto. They figured this thing out, sent up commands. It takes 22 hours, over 22 hours for a command to go all the way to Voyager at the speed of light. Another 22 and a half hours to come all the way back, find out if it worked. And first they had to diagnose, figure out what the problem was, and then eventually they set the command to override this one particular computer, maybe go to another computer. And anyway, the software people did a great job, and they are now getting reliance back from Voyager 1. Still on its way after a launch in, 1977? At Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, launched a couple of weeks apart. They're both still at it. Any comments?
Yeah, how far is that Voyager 1? How far is that thing past Pluto?
Oh, okay. I have, they go by AU, astronomical unit. One astronomical unit is distance between the Earth and Sun, and I have a website I usually use for Voyager, and bring that up. I know Voyager 1 is further than Voyager 2, then by 1, we've got this WSN, but I know the time, I have that memorized, 22 and a half hours to in one direction. Okay, here's Voyager 1, standby. From the sun, it was 15,210,000,000. And they actually have a clock that goes, you know, an odometer that ticks by. Distance from the sun, roughly 15 billion. Where Voyager 2 is a little closer to 12. 12 billion. And astronomical units, remember, from the sun to Earth is roughly 93 million miles. Voyager 2, which is a little closer to the sun, is 103, almost 137 times the distance, you know, from the sun to the Earth. And then the other one is Voyager 1 is 163, almost 164 astronomical units from the sun. They're all traveling, well, Voyager 1's going faster, is traveling away from the sun at 38,000 miles per hour. That's, you know, think about Earth, 8,000 miles in diameter, you know? And this thing, they're going, well, I think of it this way, satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit are roughly 23,000 miles away from the Earth, so, like, it's like going from center of the Earth, way past the geosynchronous satellites, just in 1 hour. It's just amazing. Seeing if there's any other statistics here. There's a whole bunch of stuff on the equipment they have on board, and on and on. Anyway, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory from NASA website, Charlie. Back to you.
This goes on almost 46 years later, and it's way past Pluto. How far to the next planet does this thing have to travel?
Yeah, I think it's would be the next location would roughly near Sirius Star. And I think it's something like 40,000 years before it gets there. I'm not kidding, 40,000 years before it gets to the next nearest star, which could possibly have a planet going around it. So that's totally amazing. And you say something else, yeah? Oh, I know, Pluto. Pluto's roughly 39 astronomical units away from the sun. So this thing is 160. So I would say over four times the distance where Pluto is. Four times that distance. That's where Voyager 1 is. Back to you, John.
Four times the distance past Pluto. I can't even grasp that. I'm sorry.
You're not the only one. I have to review this once in a while to make sure it's right what we're saying on the net. But that's the truth. It's an amazing feat, and they're still being powered. You know, it had the uranium 238 on board. You know, and they use that for the. RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. So uranium gives off heat, and it's good for half-life, it's 87 years. So it gives off heat. And they wrap that in their graphite thermal blankets. And within those thermal blankets, they have dozens, if not hundreds, of these thermocouples. And they're all hooked up in parallel and some in series. And anyway, that gives them their 28 volts and enough power, which seems like forever. You know, what we say, over 40 years of flight. Yeah, half-life of the uranium is 87 years. So whatever power it started off with will have that amount of power in another 40 years.
That's time complete.
Incredible. Back to you, Charles.
And it's still sending back data?
Yes, both of them are. And that's how I started out talking about Voyager. They were having problems. They were not getting proper data. It was all garbled. They weren't sure what zeros and ones they were sending. And eventually they figured out that it's one bad front board. And this all started back in November. It took all these months. We diagnosed and eventually sent up commands to do a workaround somehow on the with a computer. And now it's starting to send back, as a couple of days ago, too. It's starting to send back actual data. First, I needed to communicate with it. And that was a lot of cheers went up for that. But then to actually tell them what to send back and what to do. That came later, and later is now. And that's why a lot of these people are old-timers in there, too. They've been with the program forever. Some of them that came back probably out of commitment to help try to figure this thing out. Amazing story. And it's still ticking. Back to you.
Yeah, but they haven't come across any other people out there, civilizations?
No, they didn't investigate any other planet with these two spacecraft. none to be found. They know where there's, you know, different Kuiper belt objects, you know. You know, half the size or the same size as Pluto. A couple of them. Meg is one of them. A couple of others. Sedna is another one. But, there's no... Right now, investigating the effects of the solar wind, you know, once you get past the influence of the sun with the solar wind, that's what they're concentrating on. They've gone to a point quite a few years ago. Now they're just studying the intergalactic wind, a couple of units that are still on that can figure out what's going on. They don't have any cameras working or anything like that. That's long been off. Anyway, Charlie, we've gotten up to 11 o'clock. I'm going to close the this portion of the net down. We're going to turn it to Dr. Roy, and thanks for your participation. Anybody else? I should have left time for Frank. I know sometimes he gets in there. But anyway, let me just turn it back to Roy. Hopefully, we'll make tomorrow night's club InfoNet. Thoughts at 8:30. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N. Base that report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
This is AC2GS. Paul, thank you for all that you do for the Space Network and what you do for our technical net in general. All that you do for the club, we all appreciate it, and I especially do. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you'll come back next week, which is not going to be Memorial Day weekend, and when we try and do this all over again. Our revels now are done, people. As always, I like to remind everyone that K2RIW, who did this technical net for 40-plus years, would end it. The advice, be kind to each other. That's always good advice. So please try and be kind to each other. We live through interesting times, which can be exciting, but scary as heck. And I always like to mention good old hepatitis. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open and learn things, new things, every day if you possibly can. If you don't use it, you lose it, as the saying goes. So have a great remaining of the Memorial Day weekend. Stay safe, be well, and I hope you'll be able to join us all next Sunday night when we do this all over again. As always, I will be clear and close this technical net with the comment, Slava Gray.
K2HAU. I'll speak to you next week. Thank you. Bye.
Seven three, good show. WB2BX. Yeah, I think that's KG2AGU, AJU, I believe it is, WB2BX, so via Echo Link in Northeast Philadelphia, name is Frank.
The city of brotherly love, North Philadelphia, huh?
Well, I'm in Northeast Philadelphia. That's somewhat different locals than North Philadelphia.
My family came when they left Italy. They went to Upper Darby, which is in East Philly.
Yeah. No, actually, that'd be a little past West Philly, I believe, because that's at the end of the Philadelphia L, which goes through West Philadelphia and winds up at the Upper Darby line. But that's also a very different area from when it what it was in your parents' or grandparents' time. Go ahead.
You are very correct. But my family was there in the late 1800s.
Well, then I'm sure it was a different area. It is... than it is today. Yeah, but I do. I do in general know where you're talking about. So, yeah, I'm literally at the other end of the elevate line. Okay. In northeast Philadelphia.
I think it's 69th Street. I believe it's 69th Street on the station.
Yeah, you're right. Upper Darby is the 69th Street station on the Philadelphia elevated, the L as we call it here. And I'm past the other end, Bridge and Pratt end of the L, up on Roosevelt Boulevard near the Northeast Philadelphia Airport. I'm positive it did not exist when your grandparents were here.
There's another famous person that comes out of that neighborhood was from the Three Stooges, Larry Fine.
I'll ask my wife about that. That sounds vaguely familiar. A lot of famous people came from this area. These days, Philadelphia has largely taxed itself out of business, and everyone who could afford it has left. For the most part, there were certainly a lot of famous people here. Now, Philadelphia is largely an edge of its suburbs. There's still some nice northeast, parts of northeast Philly are still pretty nice. And Old Town, you know, there are some people in Old Town and Society Hill, but that's about it. Everyone else has kind of gotten the heck out of here because of the tax structure.
Yeah, well, I know what problems are there, but welcome to the new world. When my family was there, oh God, in the very early 1900s, when the L was brand new, it was...
Yeah, I'm sure it was. These days, I mean, I ride it now, and my wife and I ride it now and then. Unlike in New York, seniors provide the L for free. But we still don't really want to get on it unless we have to. We used to take it to and from work, and in rush hour it was open. But other than that, I said, even though we can ride it for free, we stay off it and we have to for some reason. And we do now and then, because it's certainly a heck of a lot cheaper than taking an Uber to Center City. Go ahead.
Yeah, but if you take the Uber, you might get where you're
going. Yeah, well, just like on the New York subways in Brooklyn, I spent most of my life, by the way, in Canarsie and then moved to Brighton Beach near Coney Island. Most of the time, you're fine. Anyway, look, I got to get going. I have some stuff to do here before I call it a night. But it was kind of fun to... talk about the WB2BXO 73.
A2HAU 73, and good night.
Good night.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Mark in phone at night at 8:30. This is the WVL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the WVL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Fly Mark InfoNet at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL.
Wow, dude.
Infonet at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Mark Infonet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL report.